It's really hard sometimes to read the word of Jesus and not get offended. Because Jesus said stuff that is offensive. Like he at first comes across so soft and cuddly and kind. Oh, we like Jesus. And then suddenly he'll say something and totally step on our toes. Like, hey, you guys ever get your toes stepped on by Jesus Christ? I have many times. And I think it's okay to feel that, and it's okay to realize, ooh, something's going on. We have to wrestle through things. If we're never challenged by Jesus' words, I sometimes wonder, are we even paying attention to what he's saying? For example, Jesus has a lot to say. He has a lot of opinions on things like our tongues, you know? Like, he wants us to control them and not lash out in hatred or in sarcasm. Like, that's something he talks about, you know? And he has opinions how we treat one another. He has opinions about our actions, but even our thought life. Like how we think about other people, he cares about, and he has stuff to say about. Like, don't hate that person in your minds and in your heart. He says things like, don't objectify people in your minds and your hearts. Like, how dare Jesus have so many opinions, you know? He's got a lot to say on prayer, family. He's got a lot to say about his father and about his own identity, a lot of which are controversial, but not as controversial as his take on money. Some of you guys thought I was going to say sex. I just said sex from the stage. That's what happens when Joshua's not here. All this controversy. I'm going to be borrowing this morning. We're going to talk about generosity in finances. I'm going to be borrowing some from Randy Alcorn. Any Randy Alcorn fans in here? He's written some wonderful books. He has a book called Giving is the Good Life, and so I'm going to be borrowing a bit from him. But mostly, I'm going to be borrowing from Jesus. Here's just a whole bunch of stuff that Jesus said about wealth. Are you ready? Okay, Matthew 6, 19. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. He says in verse 24, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. That's pretty definitive. Well, okay, Jesus, come on. Watch out, be on guard, Luke 12, 15. Be on guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. Luke 6, 20, 24 and 25. Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. But woe to you who are rich. Jesus, come on, chill, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Matthew 19, 23 and 24, Jesus said to his disciples, truly I tell you, it's hard for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, I tell you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of God. Whew. Okay, that's just a sampling. He tells entire parables about greed, like the parables of the rich fool who has so much money and so much grain, he decides to build bigger barns and store all the surplus in there, and so he never has to work. And God says to him, you fool, your life will be demanded of you tonight. Then who's going to get what you prepared for yourself? Like, that's kind of in your face, isn't it? Well, there's a couple of Christian businessmen, Greg Balmer and John Quartines, they heard this parable and they rewrote it for the modern times. They put this in their book called God and Money. Here's how they rewrote it, and I think this is very accurate to what Jesus might say today. He told them a parable saying, the stock options belonging to a manager vested after a major run-up in share price, and he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I already have enough saved to send my kids to college. My house is paid off, and I already maxed out my 401k every single year. And he said, I will do this. I will open an investment account and create passive income portfolio, and I'll exercise my options and put my money there. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have a big enough portfolio to be financially independent, retire early, plan some vacations, play golf. But God said to him, you fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the portfolio you've built, what use will it be then? So is the one who endlessly builds his net worth and is not rich toward God. Whew. Again, Randy Alcorn quotes that in his book, but he got that from their book, God and Money. The rest of the New Testament echoes this theme over and over again, okay? Keep your lives, Hebrews 13:5, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. You hear that? Like it's so direct. Keep your lives free from the love of money. 1 Timothy 6:6-10, Paul's talking to Timothy. Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. Do I need to adjust here? Take nothing out of it. I don't know what just happened. That was wild. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. This is so explicit, you guys. It's all through the New Testament. It's so explicit. He's saying, don't desire to get rich. If you do, here's a whole bunch of things in front of you. Look at all these traps he mentions, falling into temptation, becoming ensnared in a trap, succumbing to many foolish desires, giving into harmful desires, plunging into ruin, resulting in destruction, leading us into all kinds of evil, causing us to wander from the faith, piercing ourselves with many griefs. That is a lot of stuff. That is a lot of stuff. Riches promise many things, the New Testament tells us, but they are simply deceitful. You chase them thinking you're chasing the good life, and then you end up getting that list. Whew, okay, is anybody offended yet? Is anybody's toes a little bit bruised? Okay, that's okay. These are the words of Jesus and the apostles. I didn't write any of those words. These are major themes in the New Testament. In fact, there's an estimated 2,000 verses in the New Testament alone about money focusing on these themes and on the theme of providing for the poor. Excuse me while I take a drink of coffee. Thank you. So these are major themes, and they might make us feel uncomfortable as modern Americans, both because we're a very wealthy nation, and because, how do I say this? The words might sound like words that people would say on other TV networks that we don't watch. Do you know what I mean? Like, they might sound like, okay, there are people who think things that I don't think, and who might be majoring on those words that I don't major on. For example, like we have these little silos we're in. Like, for example, I mentioned TV networks. You know, you might be more of a MSNBC person, or you might be more of a Fox News person, or you might be more of a Cartoon Network kind of person. And those are all pretty much on par in my estimation, but I'm gonna get rocks thrown at me this morning. This is gonna be fun. If you follow Jesus, you will embrace the words and the ideas of Jesus, and some people who are not in those same circles or watch the other TV network might assume things about you. You know? Like if you say some things, if you quote Jesus on some things, people will assume, well, you are a closed-minded person who lives in the last century. You know what I mean? Like some will say that if you follow Jesus. And if you follow Jesus, and you quote Jesus, and you live like he says, some might say, well, you seem woke. Whew, I just dropped the W word. You know what I say to that? So what? Follow Jesus. I got one woohoo out of that. I'll take it. Follow Jesus no matter what people assume of you. You know what I'm saying? They might assume that you're over. They might think I'm part of that group. So what? Jesus is going to critique that group and he's going to critique your group. Jesus is an equal opportunity toe-stepper, you guys. He will confront every political tribe. He will confront every clique. He will confront every media outlet and people who follow those things. All of those things. Sometimes they are going to be in line with Christ. Sometimes they will not. So my encouragement to you, just follow Jesus, you know? Just follow him. Sometimes people might think you're a hippie. So what? You talk about peace that much, they're going to think you're a hippie. So what? Jesus talked about peace. Let them think what they want. Are you with me? Yeah. Are those hard words? I want to encourage you guys. Just follow Christ. Let that be your... This actually is one of my concerns about finding too much identity in any political circle or any modern circle, right? My concern is when we do that, we start accidentally ignoring some of the priorities of heaven. We might really like these ones, but not these ones over here because, well, that's not, you know? Like, so I'm not saying don't be a part of a political party or anything like that, but if we find too much identity in them, we will stop following Jesus in various areas, and that's dangerous because we're followers of Jesus, and that should be number one. Does that make sense? So the reason I bring this up is because I do think we can hear some of these things and be like, well, I don't really like that, and so I'm kind of dismiss that because that's not the emphasis of these people that I'm sort of normally known to be a part of. But the Apostle Paul, under the unction of the Holy Spirit, and Jesus himself confront the love of money. They confront greed very directly. So we have to take that seriously. It is hard as modern Americans, but if you're feeling singled out by Jesus, again, he's equal opportunity toe-stepper. It was also very hard for the ancient Ephesians who received this letter with Timothy because they were a culture that put money on a pedestal. They were idolatrous that way. And we can be too. Isn't this just a fun, cheery sermon so far? You guys are like, this is great. I love this. I'm never coming again. This is something we must take seriously because this is what they said. Okay. But lest we all be tempted now to like, oh, are you saying we need to take a vow of poverty and no one's allowed to make any money? No, it's not what I'm saying. Hear me. Money is in itself not evil. It's a fact of this world. It's what we do with it. It's how we pursue it. All of those things that can be detrimental. Money can be used to do all kinds of things, right? It can be used to bribe judges. It can be used to buy heroin. It could be used to fund terrorism. That's very bad. There's very bad things. It can be used just to indulge the flesh. But money can also be used to feed your kids, to save lives, to stay warm, to keep your family warm. Money can be used to feed the hungry, give drink to the thirsty. It can house refugees from war-torn nations. Money can protect battered women, and money can throw a wedding feast. That doesn't sound like an evil thing to me. All of the things that Jesus calls us to do in taking care of the needy and taking care of the widows and taking care of our own families, all of these things require money. And Jesus' own ministry required money. He was funded by people because he didn't have a traditional income as a traveling rabbi. So it is not a bad thing to own stuff. The question is, we have such stark warnings against greed, okay, and against that taking over our lives, but then we also have this directive to be generous with the things that we do have. So that implies that we do have stuff. So how do we have stuff? How do we deal with money without being owned by it? That's the question. You guys still with me? That's the question. How do we do that? And the answer, in my estimation, and many others, is simple. Generosity is the answer. Which is very convenient because that's the series we happen to be teaching right now. Look at that. It's very cool. Let me read a passage from Alcorn's book. He quotes his friend named Tony Samaristi. Samaristi, I have no idea how you say that, but he's a good guy. Here's what Tony says. He says, Jesus changed my life 30 years ago when I finally surrendered to him on Wall Street. The Lord quickly showed me how dangerous materialism was. It's like kudzu, the creeping vine that grows in the South. That's what materialism is. And you ask people, how do you get rid of that vine? And they all give you the same answer. You don't. You just keep whacking away at it. You just keep whacking away at it. That's how materialism works. My wife and I have found the only thing that breaks the hold of materialism in our lives is giving. Giving, giving, giving. Giving wisely, giving smartly, giving spiritually, giving generously. Generosity, you guys, is the antidote to greed. I like what Lloyd Shadrach said. We have a quote there. Generosity is to materialism what kryptonite is to Superman. Isn't that good? We know what kryptonite was to Superman. That's what generosity does. And this, you guys, I want to say is really good news, I think. Really good news. I started out with the hard news, but this is really good news. And I say that because we've already talked about in the first week of this series that it's better to give than receive. And it really is. Like, it's better for our hearts. It's better for our neighbors. It's better for society. It brings about greater joy when we live generous lives. So that the call to financial generosity is a blessing to us. It's resounding all through the scriptures. Generosity is everywhere, and particularly in the New Testament. That's one of the hallmarks of a follower of Jesus, is that we are called to be generous with our possessions. Here, let me just give you a smattering. I don't even know if we need these because it's so everywhere, but just let me give you a few. 2 Corinthians 9:11, you will be enriched in every way so that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. Proverbs 22:9, the generous will themselves be blessed, for they share their food with the poor. Hebrews 13:16, do not forget to do good and to share with others, for with such sacrifices, God is pleased. Psalm 112:5, good will come to those who are generous and lend freely, who conduct their affairs with justice. Honestly, we could go and read these verses all day long. We could have just read that all the way through, and we go way past when the service ends because it's everywhere in Scripture. I'll give you one more because I really like it. Ephesians 4:28, anyone who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with their own hands that they may have something to share with those in need. Isn't that beautiful? Paul knows that in order to be generous, you have to actually have something to give. So he calls on those who have only taken in their lives. He calls on them to work hard to get paid so they can become givers instead of takers. Isn't that lovely? Because it's more blessed to give than to receive. That's why. Now, I know I'm not saying anything particularly new this morning. My entire goal here is just to help us see how thorough and how loud the scriptures are on this topic. Because in our culture, it's gonna be easy to skim over them. It's gonna be easy to treat all this like white noise. This was a priority of Jesus, so I wanted to just bring it back to our attention and put it right in front of us. I'm not gonna try to work through, okay, wait a minute, so what are the outgoings? How do we deal with this then? You're telling us to be generous with our possessions. What do we do? We could take weeks on this, but we're not going to. I'm going to actually ask my friend John Mark Comer to come on up in just a second. He's going to be up there. We've already mentioned him this morning. He did Practicing the Way. He led us in that, and then he did a video series on generosity. And he packed so much into this clip that I thought, there's no way I could do this in one sermon. So he's going to talk about it and give some ideas and give a biblical perspective on how we should go about being generous.
We've covered a lot of ground over the last four sessions. We hit on four key themes from Jesus' teachings. There's more joy in giving than receiving. Watch out for greed. All we have belongs to God. And be generous to the poor. Now it's time to put it all together. To live a generous life will require a plan. It's unlikely to just happen. In fact, in our clickbaity, algorithm-based advertising culture of more, with an Amazon purchase here and there, which always adds up to way more than we realize, we often get our paycheck, and a week later, all the money is just gone, and we have nothing left to give. We need to develop a thoughtful, intentional plan to resist the cultural deformation of mammon and practice generosity as an act of training under Jesus in kingdom living. If you don't yet have a budget or a spending plan, that's step one, along with a plan to track your spending and stay in your budget. That's a baseline. But with this bonus session, we want to help you develop a plan to build a life architecture to house a life of generosity. To that end, let's work through a few questions you need to answer to integrate generosity into your rule of life. First, when should we start to give? Easy answer. The time is always now. You may need to pay down debt or change your financial obligations, but even if it's very small, don't wait until you have more money to give. One, because wealth is uncertain. It will surely sprout wings and fly to the sky. There's no guarantee that you will be able to give later. And counterintuitively, the less money you make, the easier it is to give. Let's say you choose to tithe. If you make $1,000 a month, your tithe is $100. But if you make $10,000 a month, it's $1,000. And it will always be easier to give $100 away than $1,000. And if you don't let your heart be formed in generosity now through practice, then once you do have more, you may not have the heart or capacity of character to give it away. In fact, there's debate on this, but most sociologists argue that the more money people make, the less generous they are. By percentage, not amount, but still, that's surprising. Some people claim that generosity is just for the well-off. But surprisingly, the most generous demographic in America is working-class Christians. Please do not become yet another statistic who just makes more and spends more. Start now, even if you start small, and go on this journey over a lifetime. But this raises the follow-up question. Where should we give? To our church, to a nonprofit, to random people on the street? There is no rule from Jesus to follow. But there do seem to be three primary objects of generosity in the New Testament. The first is the poor. This is the main emphasis in Jesus' teachings and Paul's writings. I think of Paul's summary of his decision with the apostles in Jerusalem. All they asked was that we should continue to remember the poor, the very thing I had been eager to do all along. The second is the church. This is also very clear in the New Testament. We are to give generously to our church and specifically to our spiritual leaders. Paul says things like, "The elders who direct the affairs of the church well are worthy of double honor, especially those whose work is preaching and teaching." For Scripture says, "Do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain, and the worker deserves his wages." In the same way that pastors are responsible before God to see that the community is well cared for spiritually, we are responsible to see that our pastors are well cared for financially. This may dredge up all kinds of hurt for you. You may have broken trust in institutions of any kind, but especially the church. It's really hard for our generation not to be suspicious with so many scandals. So you may need to do some vetting to make sure your church has healthy systems of financial accountability. Or you may just need to work with God and your community to overcome your distrust. But it is absolutely essential that we give in order to fund the life and call of God upon our church community. And the third object of generosity is the gospel. In the New Testament era, that meant supporting the apostles. Interestingly, Paul would generally refuse to let his church plants pay him, but he would regularly receive money from them to plant new churches and preach the gospel in new cities. He once said, "The Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel." This could look like giving to a missionary or an organization that does work with unreached people groups, or giving to cultural apologetics here in the secular West. Or maybe your local church is really keen on sharing the gospel in your own city. But some portion of our giving should go to expanding the borders of the kingdom in our city and around the world. Our generation likes to give to causes, and that's not all bad. But as followers of Jesus, our giving should be done with special attention to the gospel, the church, and the poor. But it's not limited to these three objects. We want to be generous people everywhere we go, buying a friend a cup of coffee or sending a small birthday gift. Generosity is a way of life. But then comes the million-dollar question, no pun intended. How much should we give? Again, Jesus and the New Testament writers do not give us a clear rule to follow. They don't tell us how many pairs of shoes is too many, or what an appropriate amount of square feet is for a family of four. They don't give us a math equation to plug into our budget and calculate an exact number to give away. Paul writes, each of you should give what you have decided in your heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion. Meaning, there is no set amount. We have to listen to God for direction and listen to our own heart. And this will look wildly different for my son, who's a high school senior working a part-time hourly job at Chick-fil-A in LA, than a Wall Street executive in New York City. It will look different in a small town than it will in a global city. It will look different at different stages of life. And to give you a heads up, there is no way to talk about this next part without getting into the awkwardness of class and culture. But we can't let hypersensitivity and fear of what people will say or think stop us. We need to wade in and sort out how to do this. So let me offer you five best practices from followers of Jesus who have gone before us. Some of this will be applicable to you, some of it will not. That's fine, just take whatever is helpful. First is a practice that in biblical theology is called first fruits. The basic idea is that whenever you receive income, you immediately give a portion of it back to God with special attention to the poor, the church, and the gospel. Right away, not later after you have paid all your bills and bought all the things you want or that are on your list. It's giving the first fruits or the first portion, not the leftovers. This may be a percentage you give, like a tithe, or a little more or less, or it may be an amount that changes from situation to situation as you pray about it. So, how much do we give? The first answer is at least some. That's a starting line. Next is a generosity fund. This is where you set an amount to give. It could be 50 bucks or less or way more. And you have it ready for spontaneous acts of generosity as you see needs cross your path. Years ago, we were already tithing, which we'll talk about next. But a friend of mine challenged me to start what he called a blessing fund, and to set aside 1% of my gross income to just bless people. At the time, we were on an old school cash envelope system, and every month we would have cash on hand to just bless people as opportunities came up. We still do this, and we love it. Next up would be tithing. The word tithe is from the Hebrew word maser, which means a tenth. Tithing is an ancient practice of giving roughly 10% of your income away to God and the poor. Now, there is a fierce debate in the wider church on whether or not tithing is required for followers of Jesus today. And if so, should it go to the church or to the poor or both? But whatever your view, many followers of Jesus for a very long time have found the practice of tithing to be a good baseline for a lifestyle of generosity. Now, frankly, 10% may be too much for you in this season, but for many of you, it may not be enough. The next step for you could be what's called a graduated tithe, or some people call this proportional giving. The idea is just the New Testament principle that as your income increases, you raise not just the amount you give, but the percentage you give. The more you make, the more you give. A friend of mine who has a good corporate job decided early in his career to add 1 percentage point a year to his giving. He's done well, and as of today, he's at 17%. I told you previously about another friend of mine who gives 80%. That's a graduated tithe. Another idea that's similar is called radical class distinctions. None of us like the word class, so hear me out. We all have a peer group that likely has a similar income range to us, and we tend to unconsciously adopt the spending habits of our context. And because wealth is relative, one person's luxury is another person's normal. The danger for those of us who live in the wealthiest culture in human history is that we just get sucked in. One way to combat this is to deliberately subvert the norms of our class. This could mean you pack a lunch when all your coworkers go out. It could mean you drive an old beater when your friends all have car payments. For the rich, it could mean you fly business class when all your friends fly private. For the working class, it could mean you wear a very simple wardrobe. But again, the general rule, especially for the middle class and up, is people should look at our lives, the cars we drive, the homes we live in, the clothes we wear, how often we eat out, and assume we make far less money than we actually do, because we deliberately choose to live under our means in order to give more away. How do we subvert the norms of our mammon-obsessed culture? It was said of St. Francis and his band of followers that they led a cheerful, happy revolt against the spirit of materialism. We could do the same. These are just a few ideas to spark your imagination. All of them are radical in our day and age, where so many people believe the lie that money will make you happy. They only make sense if Jesus was right, and true happiness is found in giving more than in receiving. Often, it takes us many years to learn to trust Jesus with our finances. But the more we come to trust him, the more generous we become. In fact, spiritual sages have long said that one of the most accurate ways to measure your spiritual formation is to look at your giving and how you spend your money. What we spend our money on often shows us where our true priorities lie. Wherever you are in your spiritual journey, just take the next step and do what you can, not what you can't. Maybe the growth edge for you is to double tithe and give 20% of your income away. Or way more, it's to sell everything and give it all away to the poor. Or maybe it's just to skip lunch tomorrow and give that money away to the poor. Or to sponsor a child. Or to start a blessing fund of $20 a month. Just take the next step in your apprenticeship to Jesus.
That's good, wasn't it? I am really encouraged by this idea, you guys. I'm really encouraged. It's better to give than to receive. And it becomes a huge thing to know that we can do that, to not be held captive by the blessings that God gives us. We once again are doing an assessment here. They're coming around right now. This is only for you. You're not turning this in. No one's looking at it. It's personal. But we're just going to give you a couple of minutes to look this over and to assess where you're at. We're gonna have some music in the background so you can not hear your neighbor breathe.